Thanks for listening in on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're going to turn our attention to bioenergy and talk about the role of forest products in bioenergy with a couple of guests. John Greenler back again. John's Director of Education and Outreach Programs for the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, GLBRC as we call it. John, good to see you again.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thanks, Larry.
And with us for the first time, I believe, Carl Hauptmann, who is a PhD chemical engineer with the Forest Products Laboratory in Madison. And Carl, great to have you with us as well.
It's great to be here.
You may have some questions as you listen in about bioenergy. And have you ever heard about enzymes as a tool to produce bioenergy? Those are some of the things we'll be dealing with. Certainly, I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and you can post a question or a comment there. Carl, I think when people hear the term forest products, they think of a pretty limited range of, a narrow range of things. So maybe you could tell us what falls under that umbrella term.
Well, I would say that forest products involves, lumber, which is, I think, what you're thinking of, plywood, 2x4s, things like that. There's also the forest products that we're looking at in terms of bioenergy. So things that are less useful for lumber and, for example, shavings and wood, sawdust and things like that in the making of solid wood lumber. There's a lot of work going on in trying to turn some of these byproduct materials and waste materials into bioenergy, coming up with the best use for everything. So in the grand scheme, it's always best to make solid wood lumber. That's always the first and the best use for the wood in terms of economics and things like that. But then there's a lot of material that's available in the woods that we could conceivably turn into other useful products.
Yeah. And is there a lot of material out there?
There's a lot of material. Some people don't really realize that I believe there's more standing wood now in the United States than there has ever been, as far as we can tell, since the last ice age.
Wow.
And so, there's been a lot of, a lot of standing woods or standing trees that you wouldn't necessarily call a forest. There's a lot of plantation grown material down in the South and things like that. But there are huge tracts of land still in the West.
Interesting. I know we did a show not too long ago celebrating the centennial anniversary of Forest Products Lab. It was last year. It is really an amazing place when you get right down to it.
Yeah. It has a very long history, and it's kind of it's fun being somebody standing on the shoulders of people that have been working there at the lab for more than 100 years.
Yeah, and
not particular people working that long, but
well, and the range of research is pretty broad.
Yeah, we do everything from solid wood to fire to microbiology, paper recycling. There's a very broad range of things, and the lab has kind of, it was founded in 1910, and it has kind of evolved over time. The first real forest products research that the lab really had a handle on was preserving wood ties. And you may have talked about that when you talked about the history of the lab. But that back in the early 19-teens, the big issue was that they were felling huge tracts of forest land to make timbers to build railroad bridges and for railroad ties. And these ties, you put them on the ground, what do? They rot. And so you have to replace them time and time again. So some of the early work was actually directed at that, wood preservation.
Very cool. And so now what are you working on?
I'm a chemical engineer, and I the reason I'm kind of waffling here a little is because I do many things. I'm kind of the hired chemical engineer for a lot of projects that we get involved with. So, for example, I did back in the early, around 2000, I did a lot of work with the U.S. Postal Service on developing stamp adhesives that were compatible with paper recycling. So that's an example where they needed chemical engineering. More recently, I've been doing more and more work with bioenergy, trying to extract value. I see that, you know, our work at the lab is kind of in a unique place because, you know, in Wisconsin, we have a lot of paper industry. And so the kind of piece of the bioenergy puzzle that I've been working on is, does it make sense or is there ways that we can do processes at paper mills that derive value? So, for example, you know, extracting sugar from wood before actually continuing on to make the usual paper, but then you turning that into ethanol or biofuels. So that kind of idea of interfacing bioenergy with paper mills is the emphasis at the lab right now.
So this were and does this mesh well then, John, with the rest of what's going on with the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center?
Definitely. It really fits into kind of our largest framework of looking broadly in terms of where can we find the biomass, the biological material to convert into biofuels in a sustainable manner. So it really is a matter of looking creatively for, you know, where are the residues? Where are the materials from forestry, from agricultural, et cetera, that we're really not taking advantage of, that we can utilize in a way that's really going to be environmentally sound, economically productive, you know, is really going to build, you know, an energy foundation for us in this country for the future.
Talking about forest products and bioenergy today with our two guests, John Greenler of the GLBRC, Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, and Carl Hauptmann of the Forest Products Lab in Madison. He's a chemical engineer there. Great to have them with us. You can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mealer Show, and you can post a question or a comment there. What kinds of barriers are there to working with this type of material in a bioenergy situation?
I can handle that a little bit in that, you know, John was saying forest wastes, and I was talking about things that aren't used, you know, are leftovers or byproducts of a process. And the reason that we talk about that is that nearly, you know, 50 to 60% of the cost of biofuels is in that raw material. So you need to come up with finding that raw material in a place where you can, you know, ship it or get it to a, you know, collect it into a single location. You know, because you really, for example, if you were to think about kind of packing straw into a truck and shipping it 100 miles, you know, you very quickly have used up the amount of energy that you need. You know, to ship things around, you need to get to what's called road weight, which is about 15 pounds per cubic feet. And it's hard to get there with a lot of waste. So, you know, we have to look at things where there's already what we call a point source of a waste.
Yeah. And if we can utilize that pre-existing infrastructure that we have, so as, for example, as Carl was, you know, talking about the pulp and paper industry, there's already a transportation structure there. There are the, you know, the mills are there, and we can expand our vision to that of a biorefinery where, you know, we're making those paper products, but we're also producing biofuels, and we're efficiently utilizing those resources, that infrastructure that already exists.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, actually. If you right at the source there where the processing is going on for the other product, why not?
Yep. Right. Well, and actually, if you look across the country at the what I'd say near commercial cellulosic ethanol facilities, they're all based in, you know, places like bagasse, which is the leftovers after you squeeze sugar cane, places that have large piles of things that they need to figure out what to do with.
Yeah.
You know, you really don't hear a lot about people buying wood chips to turn into bioethanol. There's a little bit of, like in Maine, there are people who buy wood chips to burn them. Mm-hmm. But it's less, you know, you really do need to be looking at these kind of already collected materials.
Yeah. Well, Rich in Summers, Wisconsin, has a comment. So let's go there. Hi, Rich.
I just wondered if they could comment on the internet how China is buying or making contracts with large pieces of land in Africa and going to grow sorghum where they can take a couple cuts a year off of it and make ethanol out of it. This country, we should be self-supporting too, you know.
Yeah. Well, John, do you want to start?
Sure. And actually, both Carl and I actually have had some significant experiences over the years in Africa. And I think, you know, one of the things that constantly comes up that I think is really important to consider is the diversity of needs corresponding with the diversity of opportunities and what are the sustainability, you know, implications. And so we really need to look at each situation on a case-by-case basis. There really is no one answer. And so, you know, Africa's needs are so fundamentally different than ours, both in terms of the nature of the, you know, the economies, the needs of the people there. And policy issues can have really large ramifications. You know, sorghum is an annual crop. You know, there can be very significant erosion problems in a lot of the arable land in Africa. And so, you know, when you have a big, you know, big economic, you know, powers coming in, I think it is very important to make sure that there is a larger vision of, you know, of what's really needed in the area and what's going to truly be sustainable, what's going to be environmentally sound for a particular area. And that's why looking at perennial crops, so if we are talking about a biofuel crop per se as compared to a residue, something like switchgrass, for example, which is a perennial, or in Africa, jatropha, which is a bush, which actually produces a very a bean which is very high in oil, once again, a perennial, may have longer-term sustainability advantages over something like sorghum, which is an annual. So sorting through those details can really take a lot of time and needs a lot of consideration.
Yeah, absolutely. We have Bill in Sheboygan Falls up with a question. Hi, Bill.
Hello, hello. Thanks, guys. You're doing good program here. And really, along the same line as you were just saying, the sustainability and examination of the program that's instituted, I fall back on observing what ethanol has done here in Wisconsin to our soils and crop rotation. It's just heartbreaking to see the clover hay fields ripped up and replaced with soybeans and corn. And I fear that you need to concentrate exactly on waste, not on harvesting out of the woodlands what are truly organic, sustaining materials.
Yeah. Thank you very much for calling. I'm going to let our guests, John Greenler and Carl Hauptmann, ponder that. We're going to take a quick look at the news, weather, and then we'll Bill will come back with a response to your questions in just a minute here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in here on the Ideas Net. Larry Mueller here talking forest products and bioenergy today with our two guests, John Greenler, who directs education and outreach programs for the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, and Carl Hauptmann, who is a chemical engineer with the Forest Products Lab. He's based in Madison, so nice to have them with us. Thank you for listening in. And if you have some questions about how forest products can be used in bioenergy, maybe some thoughts on that topic, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We had a caller who, guys who were asked about sustainability and talked a little bit about cropping and so forth for bioenergy is probably not the way to go in the long run. Comments from John, you want to start?
Yeah, sure, I can definitely start off. I think, you know, Bill raised, I think, a really valid and important concern in terms of sustainability, and especially within the context of, you know, of crop rotations and farmers, you know, having options, having choices. And really, as we look towards the future, I think this, you know, in terms of bioenergy and biofuels and biofuel cropping systems, you know, I think there's some really significant new opportunities that farmers will have on the horizon, especially when we begin to think about the diversity of lands that might be on a farm. So, for example, you know, all farms probably are primarily, you know, a lot of prime land where it's, you know, they're going to get high value from crop crops like corn or soybeans or high-quality alfalfa. And we really want to make sure that we're not diminishing, you know, that opportunity, especially in terms of producing crops that can be used for food. At the same time, I think, you know, almost every farm has some of what we would call marginal lands. These are acres that are either very hilly, they're steeply sloped and erodible, or there are wetlands and things along these lines. And there's a lot of different types of opportunities of growing perennial crops. And I think, you know, many folks have heard about switchgrass as an example, which is a native species. You know, in this area, it's part of the mix of a prairie. And it really looks like we should be able to grow those grasses, or maybe even in some cases a diverse prairie mix that would, you know, enhance the environmental, you know, factors of that land, hold that soil, you know, maintain that wetland, but still be able to take a cut from that and produce biomass that could then be converted into biofuel. And so as we continue forward with research, GLBRC, the Forest Products Lab, et cetera, I think we should be able to provide new, you know, sustainable opportunities for these growers that will allow them to diversify, become more economically stable, and also really provide what, you know, what we call, as ecologists, we would call them ecosystem services. So these are, you know, lands where, you know, we can really, you know, do well in terms of maintaining water quality, providing habitat for wildlife. I mean, the list goes on. And a lot of these perennial biofuel crops, I think, you know, can really be, you know, pardon the cliche, but a bit of a win-win, I think, for the growers and also for our, you know, for our economy in general.
Earl in Tomahawk has a question that's, I think, relates to our conversation here pretty well. So let's go there. Earl, hi.
Hi. Well, a few years ago, I heard a program on public radio, and it was about from New York, where they were harvesting poplar trees and converting them to ethanol. And I know at the time they were talking about that, they said the advantage to it was it could be harvested every 6 or 7 years. And I would imagine they're talking like clear cutting. And you don't have to plow it. You don't have to disc it. You don't need to seed it. It grows back by itself.
And yeah, there's actually been a little bit of work also done with willow, where basically you take a windrower, you know, something that's almost like a regular agricultural equipment, and you chop the material, and then it actually just resprouts right back from the stump.
Right.
And that's actually a great way to, you know, kind of improve the number of tons of wood per acre that you get off the land.
Yeah, and we actually in GLBRC we have research specifically with poplar, where we're growing poplar in trial situations, and we're looking at not only, you know, how much wood you get out and what would that translate to in terms of energy per acre, but also trying to really look at things like carbon release in terms of global warming, and also, you know, the nitrogen cycle. What do we see in terms of nutrient release? How, you know, what are the inputs versus the outputs? And so, you know, really trying to get a comprehensive analysis of exactly this type of a crop. So,
and I was curious if in the development of any type of ethanol, if a defunct paper mill would be in a position to process that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's actually
closing up here at Brokaw.
Yeah.
If you were to go on the web and look around for something called the repurposed mill study, that's been actually looked at quite thoroughly, because you're absolutely right. There's often capital basically just sitting there that you could get and start turning into biofuels. The question really becomes, you know, all of those wood contracts that were part of that mills, you know, getting wood to that mill, you know, probably fell away when the mill went down. And, you know, getting that whole infrastructure back up is actually a hard piece of this of the puzzle.
I see.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for calling.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Appreciate it, Earl. Sharon in Berlin, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Sharon.
Good morning.
Morning.
Got you on speaker. I hope that's okay. There's another person listening. In Barron County, where I used to live about 6 months ago, all of our garbage was burned and went into energy.
Yeah.
and also in the city of Barron for a number of years, they have burned scrap wood and wood chips to heat the high school and the community center. And I wouldn't be surprised if it had some connection to the hospital because it's just across the street. Those three units are right there together. But that's been going for a long time, using scrap wood, not making ethanol. But and besides, as I'm listening to you gentlemen, one of you needs to go up to northern Wisconsin and get familiar with the geography. There's lots of land up there that could be used for growing these things you're talking about, and it wouldn't be taken out of corn production or soybean production. Right now, it's probably mostly fallow. Maybe there's some beef cattle being grazed there, but there's lots of farm acreage that there's no money in dairy anymore, so they're not farming anymore.
All right, well, I'm pretty sure Carl and John are both pretty familiar with northern Wisconsin, but Carl, you want to comment?
Well, one of the things that I would say is you're right. There is a lot of land there, but again, back to this issue of how do you get the wood to a place – to a place that can actually use it in the quantities that makes sense. And so, yeah, you can grow the trees there, but then how do you get them economically down the road? But back to your question about burning solid municipal waste and wood chips, there's a couple of big efforts that have been gone. I'm thinking of the state of Maine right now, where the legislature, I believe, started putting in regulations that said you had to burn a certain amount of biofuel. And what that did is that caused a huge disruption in kind of the flow of wood chips from the land. And it's kind of interesting. So in Barron, where they're, you know, burning material that is a waste byproduct or something like that, I think that's a great idea. And that's a good use because you didn't transport it very far.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. Herb in Plainfield. Let's go to you now. Hi, Herb.
Well, hi. I have a two-part question, and the first part of my question is relates to the actual efficiency and feasibility of alcoholic type biofuels. Isn't alcohol kind of actually low energy stuff and kind of watery and in nature? And the second part of my question is: has anyone looked into, or is there any research into biofuels or generation of electricity through a more fundamental kind of area, say, based on cellular organelles like the mitochondria or the chloroplast, where, again, using kind of an enzymatic approach to generate electricity? I hate to get too technical. Yeah. Say something stupid.
I think I can handle the first question, and I'll turn the electric mud question over to John. You know, when you start really looking at the question of is ethanol economic and things like that, there's actually been a lot of work recently in the field of biofuels saying, yeah, ethanol is really not the greatest thing to be making if you're going to blend it with gasoline. Because a lot of most of the gasoline and fuel that that's in this country is shipped by pipeline. And it turns out that our pipelines are not, you know, they're steel and they're not compatible with ethanol. So you can't make a bunch of ethanol somewhere and then ship it across the country through the pipeline system, which is how we deal with a lot of crude oil. And so there's some questions about, well, can we go to other organisms that make butanol? And there is some interesting work that's being done on that. So, you know, there is a lot of work, but the big push right now, I would say, is, you know, if I'm looking at, you know, where is the real cutting edge, is in making things that are essentially drop-in. So things that are drop-in jet fuel is a big topic right now. In fact, there's several of the major, the British Airlines is working with a couple of facilities in trying to make bio jet fuel, which is an interesting question.
Hmm. Yeah, it's one of the things that's important frequently in this kind of a consideration is kind of trying to match timelines. So, for example, as Carl was saying, the drop-in fuels are really important for today. How can we come up with fuels that will fit in our current infrastructure? But one thing that's interesting is, within the context of the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, a lot of our work is looking at biofuels that really may not come into fruition for, another 20 or even 40 or 50 years. And one of the things that's become really important for us is to say, well, when we think about fuels and that kind of timeline, what are we going to be doing with these fuels? And what will the engines, for example, of the future look like? And so we actually have a collaboration now with the researchers here at UW in the Engine Research Center who are really trying to come up with those future engines. And, we've really come up with some very interesting understandings in terms of what fuels might be best for those future engines. And actually, when we look at it on that kind of a timeline, ethanol actually might be more efficient in terms of gallons per mile than gasoline. And even that little bit of water that you have in ethanol could even be to one's advantage. And so we really need to make sure that we're synced up in terms of, the fuel mm-hmm. and the infrastructure, like the pipelines that Carl was talking about, and, what that internal combustion engine might look like in the future. Just briefly kind of getting to the caller's last point in terms of kind of trying to utilize the kind of molecular machinery that's in biological systems, how those cells work. There's some very interesting research that's going on, and the caller is right on track. So, for example, there's some very long-term research going on to say, we know that plants have this very sophisticated, complex photosynthetic machinery that captures the energy from sunlight and turns it into sugars and biomass. In fact, when a physiologist looks at that process, it's not very efficient. Plants don't really do that good a job of capturing the energy from sunlight. And it does look like we might, with enough research, be able to come up with essentially a synthetic photosynthetic apparatuses, essentially artificial plants that might be much more efficient than we find growing out there today. And so really long-term research, but there might be some very fundamental breakthroughs coming down the pike on that front.
Thanks again, Herb, for calling. Jack in Wisconsin Rapids, we're on to you now. Hi, Jack.
Good afternoon. I got two quick questions. I'll take the answer off the air. I'm from Wisconsin Rapids, and we've got New Page Corporation here that's been talking for quite some time and doing studies on developing a biofuel plant here in Wisconsin Rapids. I'm wondering if what the status of that is. And then I'm also curious about, just briefly, the use of hemp for biofuel. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for calling.
I can handle the Wisconsin Rapids question pretty easily. I'm actually, I cooperate with the folks at New Page pretty regularly in my research. And the last thing that I heard about the Wisconsin Rapids mill, and this is at the Rapids Craft Division, they're working on a project where they're going to gasify slash and wood waste and produce Fischer-Tropsch liquids, which is produce liquids that are basically like gasoline. And other diesel fuel and things like that. And the last thing that I heard about that is that they're in the final stages of an engineering study where they'll actually make a go or no-go decision on that. So, I would expect in the relatively near future, they'll work that one out. They were also working on issues of financing. So that was what was going on there.
John, comment on the other part of it, the hemp?
Yeah, frequently asked question, an interesting consideration. I think, when we look at biofuel crops, and especially when we look at kind of adding new crops to our agricultural portfolio, as I was mentioning a little bit earlier, one of the things that we're really hoping to move to are perennial crops because of the fact that they really require far less energy inputs. They hold the soil. There's a whole list of actually, in fact, they build soil. And so hemp is an annual crop. You really have to plant it each year. Really limits our ability to really come up with a biofuel crop that would have the sustainability dimensions that we would be looking for. It's also a monoculture, and if we can be coming up with polyculture systems, that really further enhances the benefits of that crop. So something that would be native, that would be simulating the native prairie in this area, for example.
Let's turn to Mike in Madison next. Hi, Mike.
Hi. The question I had to do with pelletizing materials. I currently heat my home with pellets entirely. I haven't used my turned on my furnace in probably 3 years. And I'm wondering if there is, I live in Dodgeville, work in Madison, and I see all the leaves that are dumped every year and think, my God, there's a great resource that is just kind of being left to decompose. I also see that there's a variety of places where there is chipped wood. And what I'm wondering is how realistic would pelletizing on a small scale, a couple of households or just my household, what would be required? Do I need a hammer mill? How aggressive a hammer mill to break it down to a finer chip and so on?
Mm-hmm. So, California pellet mill, which is the kind of the industry standard for making pellets, it is a very substantial capital investment. So the actual pressing of the chips yourself would be probably something that would be beyond what a couple of households could do. But there's no reason why you couldn't move that a little wider. If you were going to move it to, 10 or 15 and make a cooperative, then you might be able to do that economically. The technology is actually pretty well known. The problem with leaves and things like that, as John was saying, you need to leave some of that for the soil quality and things like that. But also one of the problems with leaves is that they're really pretty low density. So, you can't afford to take them very far before you've already used up the equivalent energy.
What I'm thinking about is actually stuff that's already gathered. Madison has a dumping site for, I won't say tons of leaves because I don't know what the weight is, but there's huge quantity of leaves that are gathered in Verona. And, it's already being transported there. So if there was a minor mill or something like that that was put in a place like Verona, where it's already being hauled to, and there's brush collection points. The big question that I've always kind of stumbled on for people who I've talked to about this idea is finding the feedstock, finding the material to be transformed into. But if you have a sort of a ready source, it's sort of like the reason that they were originally made is because there was a lot of sawdust at the sawmill.
Right. Well, part of the problem with urban collected leaves is that it's not just leaves. There's a lot of rocks and sand and things in there, and no pellet mill that I know of tolerates rocks and sand very well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are some interesting examples that are quite close to what you're talking about. So, for example, there are businesses that are making pelletized switchgrass, for example. So there's a company outside of Edgerton, Wisconsin, Agricole, which actually produces seed for restoration work, et cetera, switchgrass, big blue stem and related. And they actually did exactly what you're talking about, but with switchgrass, they recognized that they had all this, the stem and leaf material, the chafe from their production. And they did actually put together a small scale setup where they could pelletize that residue material from their production and then correspondingly put in a burner, a boiler, to be able to heat their facilities with that pelletized switchgrass. And I know there are also some school districts that are doing, that have some similar projects going as well.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Bill in Madison, to you as now. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Great program. I've heard perennial crops or fuel stock mentioned a few times, and it brings to mind a program I heard you host several years ago, Larry. Wondered if you'd heard anything more about a variety of perennial corn that was discovered in Mexico.
Yes, we can, talk about that a little bit. John Greenler, he's an expert on it.
Well, actually, it is kind of a bit of a holy grail out there in agriculture, and there's been some, very long-term research going on. One particular individual, Wes Jackson, the Land Institute in Kansas, has done a lot of work looking at, this very big question of can we perennialize a lot of our key agricultural crops? And corn would be, the one that would be the biggest success. And actually, just in the past couple of years, they're still moving forward looking at that with corn. They've had really made some significant inroads with wheat, and they actually do now have some trial varieties of wheat that are perennial, and they're currently looking at some scale-up experiments to say, can we get the yield that we need to make this economically viable? What's the quality of the grain that comes out of that? Once again, I think we're not going to see perennial wheat or corn being sown in our backyards here in Wisconsin next couple of years. But I think there's a reasonable chance in the next, 10, 20, 30 years, we might begin to see some movement in that direction. And it would really, really be a big advantage for us in terms of addressing some of our agricultural challenges.
It sure would. And on that note, we have to close. The time flew by. Thank you so much. I hope we can do this again.
Always a pleasure, Larry.
John Greenler is director of the Education and Outreach Program for the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. We call it GLBRC. Carl Hauptmann is a PhD chemical engineer and works out of the Forest Products Laboratory in Madison. Great to have him with us as well to talk about forest products and bioenergy. And we'll certainly be doing this again. We have some shows coming up, obviously, tomorrow. Another day and another series of topics. And the topic tomorrow is with the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection, talking about consumer protection issues with Sandy Chalmers and Michelle Reinen. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.